I'm gonna start uploading pictures of like sloth toes to see if anyone's into it.
I'm sure there would be somebody.
Just like her little claws. Just
oh my god!
You think anyone would pay to see them?
Just toss them overboard when you're sitting having lunch, or you know, just anything of that.
The classic.
We actually were joking about setting up an OnlyFins account.
Here's to us all swimming through the shit and making more sense of it.
Wild and unprotected, planet Earth we can't neglect it. Nature sexy, we need this place, so please respect it.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Wild and Unprotected podcast. On today's show, we have two guests from the Toucan Rescue Ranch, Andres, a vet supervisor, and Tessa, a release site supervisor. Guys, welcome to the show.
Hey, happy to be here.
Thank you.
Yeah, happy to have you guys on. Well, let's go ahead and dive right into things. Andres, tell us a little bit about yourself.
So my name is Andres. I am the vet supervisor over here at Toucan Rescue Ranch. I've worked here for around 9 years doing basically literally anything that you can do over here. I've taken care of the animals, clean up after them and raise them, release them, the whole shebang. And now I work as a vet, so now I take care of them more directly.
Yeah, that's awesome. So tell me a little bit about your time before joining Toucan Rescue Ranch. You know, where you're from, what got you into conservation and that path to becoming a vet.
Yeah, well, before Toucan Rescue Ranch, I started here when I was really, really quite young. I'm originally from Costa Rica, so I've lived here my whole life. I was born and raised about a mile away from the ranch. And this was not a place that I really knew existed while I was growing up, but I'm kind of glad I stumbled upon it when I was basically like a teenager, because it kind of has guided and oriented my life ever since. Ever since I was small, I really liked animals, but it was kind of like a passion oriented to somewhere else. I wanted to be a paleontologist. That's kind of what I really wanted to be. I was a dino kid, you know, growing up. And when I went
to... So you like the dino chicken nuggets?
Oh, absolutely. You know, like the cheesy ones with the cheese in the middle. I love those. Made my mom like get them for me all the time. And it's really fun because I always told my mom, like, I'm eating nuggets that are made of dinosaur in the shape of dinosaur. And that's amazing. But yeah, no, I was kind of that kid, and growing up, really, really always liked animals. Really passionate about things like conservation. Loved watching Steve Irwin. Loved watching Sabu Bafu growing up, that kind of thing. But when I was in high school, it's the origin story for most conservationists, I feel. Growing up, went to high school, and in high school, I kind of stumbled upon this place on a garage sale of all places. And before going to college, I decided to do a small volunteering here, and I just never left. I've stayed ever since.
That's awesome. I think that's the first mention we've had of Sabu Mafu, right, Koji, on the show?
Yeah, I would say definitely a first.
Really?
Core memory unlocked right there.
Absolutely. I have the song stuck in my head now, by the way.
Oh, gosh. We'll have to be careful not to dive too deep into that. I think we get like 3 seconds of copyrighted material before we get struck. So that's awesome. Definitely a good origin story there. And it's funny that you stumbled upon the Toucan Rescue Ranch when you were raised a mile away from it. Wild how that happens.
Yeah, no, wildlife rescue centers in our country, they're usually not for locals. And so, I was blessed to stumble upon this place and, find the opportunity to be able to start working in this way. Like most places in Costa Rica, they don't cater to locals or even usually at that point in time allow them to come in. So I was very blessed that I could stumble upon this place and like get to open the doors up a little bit more for locals also in the future.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, let's get to Tessa. Tessa, tell us a little bit about yourself and your background.
Hi, my name is Tessa, and I'm the release site supervisor here at Toucan Rescue Ranch. I've been here for almost 2 years now. I started out as an intern, much like Andres. Not as long of a backstory, but I did volunteer when I was 17. That's how I first came across Toucan Rescue Ranch, because my uncle, funnily enough, lives about a mile from the rescue center. So I grew up coming to Costa Rica every summer because my family lives here. And when I was visiting my uncle, he was mentioning about the rescue center that was about a mile away and that I should do a volunteering thing there since I was interested in working with animals. And so that's how I came across Toucan Rescue Ranch. And that's my first more hands-on experience with working with wildlife. But it was always something I wanted to do as a kid. Like I was also a Zabumafu kid. And I remember watching that and falling in love with wildlife in Costa Rica every summer as well as kind of what inspired my journey to become a biologist.
That's awesome. So you said you visited Costa Rica as a kid. Where are you originally from?
I'm from the United States. My dad is from the US and my mom is Costa Rican.
Awesome. Multicultural. We love that here. Well, let's dive into Toucan Rescue Ranch. Tell us a little bit about the organization and what you guys do.
Well, we are, as an organization, we opened up our doors in 2004. Obviously, I was a little toddler back then, so not quite in my 9 years, but that was kind of like we opened our doors to kind of deal with the problem. There's a lot of systematic issues in regards to conservation work in our country. But one of the biggest ones back then in the early 2000s was that animals that were not like macaws and were not in government programs were not being catered to, and they were not being rescued, and they were often just being put in like the back cages of really bad institutions. And so we opened our doors to try to receive animals at other places, which just simply not. And we started with toucans being one of the biggest ones because people really didn't care about toucans back then. Not that they do now, but, you know, a little bit more at the very least. Quickly moved on to housing parrots. There's a huge parrot problem in Costa Rica. They're very illegal to keep in captivity, but there's thousands of them in captivity and there's no rescue center owned by the government. So government confiscates those parrots and then just spreads them everywhere. So we're kind of one of those centers that started getting those parrots. And then we moved into housing mammals and we moved into housing sloths. And that was before the sloth craze of 2010. So that was in 2007. And when we started receiving sloths, it was like this big thing for us because nobody knew anything about sloths. Again, not that people know about sloths now, but certainly we did a lot less back then. And around 2014, we started our programs to begin the rehabilitation process for sloths. We became a very successful toucan breeding facility for a little bit, and we were the first in the world to breed the emerald toucanette. Nowadays, we just kind of focus on different types of programs. Our star program being, of course, our sloth program, which is where I work very, very closely in. And we kind of just do sloths, do toucans, do a little bit of everything else. That's us.
That's awesome. And speaking of sloths, I think we have a potential special guest hanging out. Tessa, do you have that special guest with you?
Yes, we do. We have an arrival this morning of a young female sloth. She is 620 grams. She's really small, hanging on right here. But she's got her little heating pad in her bucket to keep her warm. And she'll be transported to headquarters on our supply run later today, where she'll start in the infancy of our program. So the smallest orphans start at headquarters before they then get transferred when they're a bigger size, ready to adapt more to wild habits here at the release site.
That's amazing. I guess that shows the work doesn't stop even when you have to record a podcast.
Yeah, I'm babysitting right now.
You have no idea. Like, I'm 5 seconds away from being called on like 4 different emergencies. And it's like insane. Right before we started recording, we received a bird that was like attacked by a cat. So crazy.
Man, it's something new every hour then, seems like.
Yeah. No, and we're starting baby season.
If that's not some Looney Tunes shit, I don't know what is.
Oh, it's the worst thing in the world. People and cats, I swear.
Well, Koji, I think that's our first baby animal guest. I know during a discovery call we had a baby howler monkey before, but this is the first on the show.
This is true. This is our first baby sloth on the show. Our first baby animal on the show that isn't our own pets.
Yeah, she's participating. She's listening closely.
So question, Tessa, when someone brings in like a baby sloth like that, like, what does that usually look like? Is it just like an emergency, like 911? Because I'm envisioning like, you know, like an ER, like nurses show up, a doctor shows up and instantly starts assessing the situation. What does it look like when someone drops off, you know, an injured animal or just an infant animal?
Yeah, it can definitely get kind of hectic depending on what is the emergency. For this one, luckily, she seems to be healthy. Her mom was found dead on the side of the road, unclear reasons. So potentially a car or not really sure. But she seems healthy. She was very active and feisty this morning. We were checking her out. You would think like you wouldn't be too frightened of a 620-gram animal, but the teeth on her are already quite sharp and could definitely hurt. So we had to like restrain her head, take her blood, make sure she was showing, you know, healthy signs. She drank some Pedialyte to make sure that she was hydrated, got some leaves in her, and now she's taking her morning nap. And you can hear the macaws screaming in the background. I'm so sorry.
Don't be sorry. That brings the wild to the Wild and Unprotected yeah. podcast.
Definitely.
Literally in the middle of my little jungle right now.
That's great. And would you say that when an animal is feisty upon arrival, that's more than likely a good sign?
Definitely. I love the feisty arrivals. That's how you want to see them, because when they're not, then that's when you need to worry. But luckily she's doing well right now.
It's funny, Koji, that you brought that up. You talked about it being, you know, kind of like an ER, you know, someone's rushing in with like a baby sloth in their hands. And to me, I was thinking the complete opposite, and was thinking like someone, you know, is like, oh, I got this bag with, you know, a baby sloth in there, this little box, you know, kind of like a homeless puppy or something. And they're like,
Yeah, it is a bit more like that, actually, especially when it comes to the baby animals. They just arrive in like a cardboard box with usually people's t-shirts or like old blankets or like old clothes they're wrapped up in, and like the rattiest stuffed animal you'll see that they're clinging on to. And it's normally like a massive box as well. And then there's like this tiny sloth at the bottom of it. It seems like no one has like small transportation for them. But she's actually in like a storage shelf container right now. So we got inventive with it.
No, and the hilarious part is that it can certainly be both. You know, like you can get babies like that for sure. But like over here at a headquarters, when we receive emergencies and we receive like, I don't know, like a raccoon that like got chemicals poured on its back, which has happened. You know, everybody's like, you know, everybody's full on ER mode. It's like Grey's Anatomy with just about as much drama. And everybody's just like, you know, coming in with the animal inside, anesthetizing the animal, you know, like trying to get it somewhere, you know, put it in on the table, doing the entire examination and then treating it, usually bringing in even like skin grafts of like fish skin and things like that to try to like manage it in the best way possible. So it's certainly... it can be either or, and it's pretty funny. Or like,
definitely. Yeah,
or like, I don't know, somebody tried to put a raccoon in their car to try to transport it to us because it was sick, and then it escaped in the car. And so they arrive here, they jump out of the car, they close the car, and the raccoon is like loose in the car. Things like that happen.
Wow. You guys are starting with the wild stories like pretty early on in our show.
I didn't think we were going to start with Rocky Raccoon's origin story.
It's just the nature of the job.
Yeah, right? Actually, yeah. Or like, you know, somebody, sometimes the firemen come with a bag and they're like, you're like, what is in the bag? And they're like, oh, you know, a 3-meter long snake. And you're like, why did you bring
me? My favorite is when, my favorite is when they're like, okay, we're bringing you this baby and it's like this species. And we're like, okay, we're all prepared for it. And it comes and it's a completely different animal, like not even close to it. And we're just like, okay, we have to redecide what we're doing right now because this is not the animal that they thought it was. And yeah, it happens very frequently.
Yeah, it's wild. Well, let's talk about the vet program a little bit. You know, things are obviously crazy. And, you know, Andreas, like you were talking about, sometimes you guys go directly into triage mode. Let's transition to the vet program. Tell us a little bit.
Well, over here, our facility, we do kind of like a little bit of everything. So we are a rescue first and foremost. And so everything that we receive over here is, you know, comes from the wild for a reason or another. And while we do receive animals that often like may come because they were pets and they were confiscated, things like that, the reality of the situation is that we receive a lot of trauma, a lot of trauma. So we receive, you know, broken wings. I just received, you know, that little bird that would like one of his limbs was amputated by a cat, you know, like little chew toy style. And then, you know, we receive little bits of literally anything that may come. We even have done rescues on the road. So like, I don't know, a tapir went into somebody's yard and we had to get it out, or a tapir was run over by a truck and we had to, you know, go in and do the necropsy on the field because the animal died. We had to move it on the off the side of the road and then, you know, do the whole thing there. Somebody, you know, saw a red rocket deer get attacked by a puma and they chased away the puma. They grab the rocket deer, put it on their pickup truck, and then drive it to us with puma gashes all over its body. That's kind of like the types of trauma that we receive. And then, of course, we also work with animals that are permanent residents that we couldn't release back into the wild. And so, you know, we do the whole shebang of like how to take care of them and, you know, their general testing and their general like physical exams and that kind of thing. And we also work a lot with the animals that don't make it. So doing investigation on, you know, the necropsies. I'm doing investigation on the animals that didn't make it, that could have not made it because of diseases and things like that. So we're kind of like at the forefront of trying to discover new diseases, discover new things that are coming in. And yeah, it's very interesting. It's very cool. I like it a lot.
Yeah, and I could imagine it is, and I can imagine that every day is different in the program and at headquarters.
Yes, there has not been a single day in my memory that has been the same for the last 9 years, which is a good job incentive for sure.
Yeah, I could imagine never a boring day. Well, I know a lot of the goals of, you know, doing that kind of work and, you know, working throughout that entire process as a vet is to get an animal to the point of re-releasing it back into the wild. So, Tessa, can you talk about the release program and how that kind of differs for you guys more than other organizations?
Sorry, I'm very, very, very sorry to say this right now, or maybe it's a good thing to kind of catch, but the environmental police is right here, right now, and they're bringing an animal. So
you got to step away.
I'll BRB.
Okay, go ahead. We'll continue the recording and you can hop back in.
The classic, honestly. But anyway, so here at the release site, because of our location, we're located in kind of an area that's super fragmented forest. So we're located near a lot of like agricultural land, and we're like kind of rural Costa Rica, but also at the edge of one of the biggest national park in Costa Rica, Braulio Carillo, which basically is the route that connects us to headquarters as well. So we cut through right through that pass in order to get to San Isidro. And a lot of the kind of human-wildlife conflicts that happen and emergencies that we receive actually happen closer to us. So the clinic here functions as an emergency clinic a lot of the times, where the initial kind of stabilization of the patient often occurs. So my job is kind of all over the place in that sense of like it's here in the clinic helping out the vets when needed. It's the end of the release kind of process of rehabilitation in the last stages and what happens like when an animal's just about ready to go. And the way that works on the rehab side of things for a long care patient is we send them to headquarters. And then when they're ready to almost be released back into the wild, they normally come to us. So, for example, it functions differently for every species. But for our sloth program, for example, at a certain weight, they get transitioned from the stages that we have, getting like weaned off of milk, starting to kind of have a more of a smoothie that's like mixed with leaves and a more fibrous kind of meal, basically. And then once they get to the release site, they're completely weaned off of any milk or smoothie component, and they're eating solely leaves, and we're introducing them to a variety of different species, because we only send one species of leaf to headquarters because it's the most durable, it's long lasting. And it's also hard to collect. Like today alone, we had the guy who cuts our leaves for us cut 800 leaves. And that's going to be enough to last headquarters till Monday, and enough left over for us to use today and tomorrow. So we get leaves cut for our sloths almost daily, either to send to headquarters or here. And then a huge component of like what the interns do here is collecting wild diet items. So for the sloths, that's the variety of leaves that they're going to see in the forest. So we're literally like climbing up ladders, cutting leaves from the trees, giving them to the sloths in the enclosures. And for the birds, for example, we're cutting the wild fruits that are here. Even leaves as well, they like to tear it apart and it's enrichment for them. But coconuts, berries, all kinds of things that, depending on the season, what's in fruiting basically as well. And for our monkeys as well, the leaves and fruit component, the wild diet component, is super important for animals that came to us as orphans that didn't have their moms, for example, or their troop to show them what to eat and what they can eat in the wild and what they should be looking for. So it's really important for that step to be done here for the animals to get introduced at that critical age at all the foods that they can eat in the wild, so that when they're released, they're like, oh yeah, I've eaten this a million times before, and it's not something foreign to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know that's something that you and I discussed on our discovery call, mm-hmm. was the wild diet, and I know we're going to hit on that here in a little bit, probably when Andres gets back. But that's awesome that you guys are able to make two different sites work. I know that that's difficult for a lot of organizations just because of mass coordination, and especially because, you know, animal diets are typically different depending on where they're located. So that's amazing that you can make that work. I think something that we can hit on really quickly that you can touch on is how both you and Andres kind of work together with the two different positions of, you know, release site supervisor and veterinary supervisor to make the program work between the two sites.
Definitely. Yeah, communication between us is super important for many reasons, obviously, but for mostly the health and care of the animals. So for the animals that are here under my care, you know, it's my job to report to the vet supervisors, like how they're doing. If any changes are happening, he helps create, like, you know, we have a vet here on site, but he helps create our like treatment plans and things like that for animals that we have here. And the coordination of when animals are ready to come over here as well is super important to be able to like have the enclosure space and the right timing for things, because we can't just transfer animals if there's not a pre-release enclosure here. So it really does need to be coordinated, and we have to think a lot in the future of like, okay, so this sloth will probably be ready to get moved into the pre-release enclosure in like this X amount of months. We have this many babies, so then we can shift them over here at this point. And so a lot of that is super important for us to be able to communicate with. And wanted to, I think you asked in the previous question about kind of the release process. Don't know if you wanted me to touch on that for a little bit of like,
yeah,
how we release animals and like that kind of thing.
Yeah. Let's go dive into the release site and what you do.
Yeah. While we're waiting for Andres, might as well. And okay. So for the sloth, for example, which is one of our most successful programs, the reason it is so successful is that we're able to monitor post-release. So they have tracking collars that are usually on them for about 3 to 6 months post-release, depending on their behaviors and how they're doing. But the purpose of the collars and to be able to like monitor them so closely is to be able to watch their movements, see how frequently they're leaving one tree, going to another tree. If they're in trees that are, you know, that have leaves that they can eat. And it's super important for us as well to do checkups on them even post-release. So we're not, it's not like a weekly thing or anything, but when the sloths are at kind of an opportunistic level to be able to recapture and bring them into the clinic, we do a health checkup with the vet to make sure that everything's looking good. Are they maintaining weight? Hopefully they're gaining weight. That means they're still growing. They're finding food that they need to find, because when we release the sloths, they're not like fully grown adults yet. They are adults, but they will still get much bigger with years after being released. So we want to make sure that their blood chemistry looks good, that they are not dehydrated. All those kinds of things are super important for us to follow up on to make sure that the releases we're doing, we're checking up on them to make sure that they are indeed successful and that they are thriving in the wild. And the same thing, we just released 6 scarlet macaws, and they also have tracking devices as well. So right now we're tracking a sloth every day that has a collar. We're tracking those macaws, which has proven to be a lot harder than the sloths because they fly. So we're always like, oh my God, we just got to ping that way. And now the tracker's pinging that way. They've completely flown across the field. Now we have to go look for who it is. But it's been a lot of fun. And it's my favorite part of the job is seeing the animals that we care for back in their natural habitat where they belong.
Yeah, that's amazing. I know the Scarlet Macaw program was something that you guys are really proud of. And that's a newer program, right?
So yeah, it is actually the first macaw release in Toucan Ranch, in Toucan Rescue Ranch's history. And all of them came as young macaws, like fledglings, but they were confiscated from households. So like kind of Andres touched upon briefly, is like the illegal pet trade is still something that's very prevalent in Costa Rica, but also the whole world, you know? And so to be able to, you know, bring those animals back into the wild when they shouldn't have been taken from the wild is super rewarding, and nothing beats watching them fly around. They're so beautiful to watch. So it's really nice to see.
Yeah, I could imagine. I don't think Koji, have you experienced a macaw fly?
I have
before?
Not.
I have at a zoo.
No, but I've never seen one in the wild, but I'm sure.
You'd have to come to Costa Rica and visit.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. We have so much planned for Costa Rica. But yeah, I mean, just the birds alone in that part of the world, they're just exotic, you know, and it's normal there, but then when you leave somewhere that doesn't have animals like that, it's truly beautiful. And I can tell that you're passionate.
I grew up like coming every summer, and I'm still in awe of it. So it's definitely not something that I think that you can just get used to, especially if you're like an animal lover. They're just so gorgeous that you can't help but watch them, you know? I think people who lived here all their life, I think, are still like, oh, look at the macaw. I know my family's still like, oh, they're so beautiful, you know? And they've like, I have like aunts who are 80, you know, and still getting super excited about seeing these animals in the wild. So I think it's nice that something like that can connect not just people who like work directly with wildlife, but anybody.
Yeah. I mean, I know you know what wildlife is like in California, but in Florida, I think the bird wildlife is pelican based. You have a couple of falcons every now and again, and then a shit ton of pigeons and seagulls.
Yeah, definitely. Don't forget about the hawks. There's definitely the hawks out there too.
Yeah, we got our ospreys as well and our herons. Yep.
Now I think about it, there are a shit ton of birds in Florida.
It's yeah, just there really are. It's actually not a bad place for birding at all.
Yeah, we just had those flamingos show up all along the Gulf Coast.
What?
Yeah, flamingos. Oh my goodness. They got pushed off of the Yucatan from Idalia, Hurricane Idalia, and they were showing up all across Southwest Florida and all the way up to the Nature Coast. So like 200-mile stretch.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, incredible. And people were like,
so you did get some exotic visitors over there.
Yeah. It's crazy how a storm that big can push them across, you know, such a big body of water that they're just like, hey, we yeah. should probably go.
Yeah, evacuate.
I love how everyone's evacuation plan or vacation plan just involves Florida at some point. they wanted to go to Disney or something.
Right. Before we get too far into this week's episode, I wanted to give a quick shout out to our sponsor. Our sponsor this week is you, our listeners. How? Well, now that we're a nonprofit, the donations that we receive go directly towards funding our shows. Want to help or need more information? Visit wildscapeproduction.com/donate to support the show. We're so thankful for the support. You make the show exactly what it is.
So howler monkeys, where do I even start? I've always been like a primate girl. Like that was always like the dream, like Jane Goodall. That's my origin story. Like I was always like, I'm going to be here one day. And so primates and monkeys here in Costa Rica were always my favorite. I was always craning my neck up to look at all of the monkeys I could when we would go on hikes here in the jungle and things like that. And when I started working here at Toucan Rescue Ranch, we like had monkeys come to us, but we'd always transfer them to another site that already had existing programs. But where we're located here in like kind of in the Caribbean slope, because it's not really coastal and we're not in central Costa Rica, it's a very unique habitat. And there's not really another rescue center that's anywhere around us in this area. The closest one on the coast is all the way in Puerto Viejo and Jaguar Rescue Center. And it's so far from
us. We don't know anything about that place.
It's like a 3-hour drive from us here. So sending monkeys over to that coast didn't really make sense because it's the habitat's completely different. And then we had the arrival of a monkey that was an amputee. It had its arm amputated because it had an unfortunate incident with a jaguar, actually. But that was it wasn't near Jaguar Rescue Center. It was somewhere else.
And, shout out to NCAR.
And so we were like kind of given the responsibility to help with the rehab process. And then we were going to see if we could transfer this monkey somewhere else for release. And it just so happens that within a week of us getting that amputee to rehab, we got another orphan baby. And they were maybe like 700 grams apart. So it was still like a feasible friendship that could form between them. Both of them were still young monkeys. And at the time I was working with a clinic intern who had experience with howler monkeys in Mexico. So previously nobody really wanted to delve into the monkey world because nobody had a background in it. And before I came to Toucan Rescue Ranch, I did an internship at another center in Costa Rica that primarily was working with howler monkeys. So with my experience combined with her experience and then these two monkeys, we were presented with a unique opportunity to start thinking about, well, do we want to start working with howler monkeys? It was always the argument as well that, like, you know, you can't raise one monkey by itself. So when you're starting a program, it's like, well, how can you accept one monkey and then just be like, well, I hope another one comes to you that it can be friends with. Not good for its social health or anything at all. So with this, it was brought into discussion with like the vet team, the animal care team as a whole of like, well, should we start rescuing howler monkeys? And that decision kind of like was backlogged in the sense of like, well, we have two. So now like, let's work with them and see where that gets us. And then came January of 2023 when we had about 15 arrivals in 1 month. So that's averaging an orphan howler monkey arriving every other day. And all of a sudden we were like, okay, we're starting the howler monkey program because we have so many, we can build a troop now. Unfortunately, like most of these orphans came from electrocutions. That's like the main problem that's presented in howler monkeys. And the reason that we got so many in January specifically is because it's peak dry season. So in this time, howlers are kind of expanding territories, looking for food, looking for those fresh young leaves, looking for fruit, and it's harder for them to find. So they're moving around fragmented jungles, and a lot of times the only thing that they can do to like get from one piece of jungle to another patch of forest is using either the roads, which then poses a danger of them being hit by cars, or attacked by domestic animals. We also have had intakes with mothers that have died due to dog attacks and the orphan survives. or they're crossing with the telephone wires. So they're getting electrocuted by using that to cross. So the threats are just imminent. Like things just happen, and during the dry season, it gets really bad. And this year we had seen more than we ever have before, which was crazy here. That was probably the craziest. I think I worked 12-hour days every day, every single day that month. And then not to mention waking up every 3 hours to feed the baby orphans. It was such a fever dream that month. I have no idea like how my team got through it and how we survived it. But now we are like reaping the benefits of our like, you know, hard work, because we did get to release our first two howlers last week. And one of them was the amputee howler, and watching him, just the confidence that he has gained since arrival, of like being able to release all of his limbs, including his tail, and jump from one branch to another branch with such confidence, has been so rewarding. And we also released him with another one that we got in January, who was much bigger than the other orphans that we got, but still too young to be on his own. And it is common for male howler monkeys to be on their own in their wild, in the wild for years before they like find a female to pair up with. And so these boys are kind of exploring things together still, because they're kind of like brothers, adopted brothers, in the sense where that they, you know, grew up together. And just watching them, you know, practicing how to jump from tree to tree, because the enclosures, obviously, we don't have, we're fundraising actually for bigger pre-release enclosures. Right now we just don't have an enclosure space that can allow them to practice jumping from tree to tree, you know? So watching them build that confidence and learn those skills as we're like closely monitoring them, has been so fun and so fulfilling. And just like being at the start of this program and then watching how far it's come and how much further that I want it to go has been like the best part of my job.
That's unbelievable in all the best ways. How do you think this program is going to grow in the future? I know you and I had talked separately about how this is kind of, you know, your legacy and your stamp on this. How do you envision this growing?
Really, like what I kind of briefly mentioned before is we need the space to house these troops that we're forming. You know, the ideal thing to have is just space for them to be independent, to be able to practice in as much area as they can, because in the wild they are going to be, you know, their territory is quite large, so they need to be able to have like that spatial awareness and like foraging for food and all of those things, the components that have to play into them being prepared for release, is super important. But the program in general, it's hard to talk about like the growth of the program, because you obviously even don't want to have it, you know, like I don't want there to be another January where I'm getting 15 orphans that are losing their families, losing their mothers, and are just being like abducted by aliens. Like literally, it's so hard to watch them. You know, they cry a lot. They're just in an infamous, they're so much like us that it's heartbreaking to see. And they have to spend a time in quarantine as well, separate from other monkeys. So a lot of times we can't even like put them with another conspecific until the quarantine time is up, because the last thing we would want is for one of them to be sick and then everyone gets sick. So we have to be really careful with that as well. And so January was like not only like tiring because of the literal hours we had to work, but emotionally draining too, watching all these babies, you know, lose their whole troops and lose their families. And when we can finally put them together and finally start like socializing them, and the way that, oh, it's so beautiful. So frequently when we put them together, the first thing they do is go up to each other and they just start like licking. They just go like, and they start like kissing each other, and they're just like in an embrace. And a lot of times they just like spend the whole rest of the day just sat right next to each other. Like, I'm not leaving your side. And it's like immediate friendship of like bonding of like, I just feel like they're saying like, we've been through the same thing, you know, like, and they're just finally get to be with another animal that's just like them after being, like abducted by these like weird hairless aliens that they're like, I don't know what they are, but we're not supposed to be with them. And so that's why it's so beautiful to like just watch them naturally adapt to like their troop. And a lot of times we get kind of questions of, well, if you're hand raising them, don't they get, you know, attached to you? And of course, there's that sense of like, you know, I have to be the adoptive mother for some time when we're hand feeding them every 3 hours. But the point is for them to be with each other. So at the proper times, we start distancing ourselves from them. They start spending less and less time with us. And if you do that at the critical stages, it's kind of like, you know, humans where you have the mom in the grocery store holding a toddler's hand and the toddler wants to be right next to mom. But when that toddler turns into a teenager, they're like, oh, mom, get away from me. I don't want to like hold your hand in the grocery store anymore. I don't even want to go with you to the grocery store. So if you start, you know, letting that teenager socialize with other teenagers, then they're like, wait, I want to stick with them. I don't want to be with mom anymore. And that's genuinely like the most beautiful part is just like watching them actually just become their natural wild selves, you know, because the point isn't for them to love you. As much as I love them, I don't want them to love me back in the same way or else they won't be successful releases back in the wild. So watching them play with each other, watching the two monkeys that we've released, you know, experience the wild together and learn everything together. That like brotherhood bonding is like so, so special to be able to just watch from afar, you know?
Wow. That's like such a bittersweet, like, notion too. Like you, like yeah, how you said, you know, like you don't want them to love you back as much as you love them, because it's not the point. The point is that they have a successful release back into the wild. Yeah. That right there is kind of like, you know, I bet that's the driving factor right there to kind of keep you coming back.
And exactly. And that's the driving force, is that the love I have for them and the want for them to be back in their natural habitat is more important than any selfish reason to want to be like, you know, touchy with them, because they are adorable and they are like so cute. And you like this like little sloth right here, you know, like the last thing she wants me to do is like hug her or touch her. You know, she's so vicious. She'll scratch me and bite me. But like people look at this cute, cuddly creature and they're like, oh, I just like, I want that. But that's not the point. That isn't what wildlife is here for. Wildlife isn't here for us. You know, they're existing as their own individual creatures in the wild, and they deserve that. And they're not here for us. They're not here for our entertainment. But we get to enjoy them just by watching them, you know, and that's enough for me.
Damn. I don't even think I can put words to that, you know, being able to selflessly kind of put yourself aside and, you know, your own innate desires, because I think every human, you know, has that desire to connect with something that they deem, you know, cute and cuddly, or, you know, express that love for another creature. You know, I know that happens with interhuman relationships, but that's also something that, you know, is very prevalent with human and animals. I mean, you look at the relationship people have with dogs, with cats. You know, I know, you know, people who live on, you know, farms also have that relationship with horses and, you know, other animals. So, and they want that mutual love back. And for you to have to be like, okay, you know, I have to take myself out of this. And while, yes, of course, I want them to love me back, you know, I can't have that because it's so impactful to the program. That just sounds excruciatingly painful, at points, but also I'm sure, you know, there's a great reward when you do get to see, you know, those first releases after what sounds like, you know, a hellish January of going through building that program and having, yeah, you know, so many monkeys come through. I'm sure that release point where you're like, oh, fuck, that is great. You know, I'm sure that helps alleviate that pain that you go through when you're like, no, don't love me as much as I want you to love me. Don't love me.
Yeah. And that's why I have a dog. I have a 2-year-old puppy, and she adores me and she follows me around, you know, whenever she can. So that's where I, you know, have to balance it out for myself.
I think Koji and I can relate. I think between the two of us, we have 5 dogs.
Oh my gosh. Mm-hmm. I wish.
We have a squad between the
two of us. That's so cute.
Well, let's, I think we can probably.
This has been gone a while. I wonder if they brought a bunch of animals.
Well, I'm wondering if he got arrested.
Yeah,
environmental police came. Nabbed Andres.
So, Tessa, this is an interesting part of the show that I know that you've probably done your research on and dug into the archives for. We like to kind of dive into some wild stories and bring out some of those experiences that the public doesn't hear of or that you don't regularly talk about. And they don't have to be crazy, which they have been. If you've seen any of our recent episodes, they're definitely crazy. But whatever experiences come to mind that you want to share, do you want to dive into that?
Yeah, sure. Let's see. Well, what happened recently, it's funny that Andres mentioned this earlier with the raccoon, because I was like, oh, you stole my story. But so we have this, everyone who works for the organization, you know, as in some capacity, like, is here to work with animals or like has experience working with animals, whether that's just like an education background or hands-on background. Because the tour guides, for example, are also biologists. They know a lot of, they don't work hands-on directly with the animals, but it's important for them to know about them, right? So probably one of the only people who doesn't know much about animals is our human resources person. And he helps us with like the weekly supply runs. So it's from headquarters, we receive medications or we receive our food that we give to the animals. So super important, you know, for that transportation to, and we transport animals. And so he is someone who helps us with those runs. And oftentimes the funniest parts of, you know, my day are like watching him just be like, I have to take what to headquarters? And normally he's like super nervous about it because he just is unfamiliar with it. So even though they go in kennels and everything in his car, he's always like, oh, I don't know about this one. And in his first week that he was here, we told him he had to transport a crocodile. And he thought that was a joke.
Oh, hell no.
It was not a joke. And we were like, yeah, you're going to have to take a crocodile to headquarters. And he was like, what? No, you're kidding. And luckily, nobody told him until he showed up, but it was like a tiny baby crocodile. So it was fine. But it was like his first week on the job and he was like, I have to take a crocodile. And so that's kind of how his like experience with Toucan Rescue Ranch started. And then a couple weeks ago, we were transporting an adult raccoon in a kennel. And this raccoon is massive. And so just by looking at him, you're like, oh, God, that's scary. Like for me, that a massive raccoon is scarier than like a baby crocodile. So we locked him in his kennel. We put it in the car and he was off on his way. And about 20 minutes later, I get a text that says ayuda, which is help in Spanish. And it's a picture of the raccoon in the front seat of his car. And he's on the outside of the car. Yeah. And he's just taking a picture of it. And it's literally like about to start driving away, this raccoon. And he's like, you need to help me right now. So I had to get in our work car and drive and like coax the raccoon back into the kennel. Secure the lock better because I think he unlocked it. Like he must have. I don't know. Like raccoons are super good with their like little fingers and things. So he must have unlocked it himself and just started like wandering on the car. He said he was looking in his like review mirror and he just sees this little like face pop up. He was like, oh hell no, and pulled over and immediately got out of the car. So it was funny. I had to go on like a rescue mission for a human, not an animal, for the first time.
Holy shit, it really is Rocket Raccoon's origin story.
I know, that's why when Andres was saying that, I was like, what? That's my story.
Well, I'm sure he has an interesting story or two that he's going to hate not being able to tell us because he got kidnapped by the environmental police.
Yeah, you might have to honestly like reschedule a portion with him because I'm sure he has so many. With 9 years working here, I bet he's got stories on stories on stories.
Yeah, we'll have to see. Unfortunately, travel schedules get pretty crazy. And this was kind of like the last day we could do this. And this actually, yeah. It might be the last episode of the season for us, for 2023. So that we have one other pending right now. So you guys might be the season cap for us. So I don't think he's gonna miss his chance. Okay. And then I have to give him shit because I was hoping to maybe tease something else that him and I had talked about. Now we don't get to do it anymore because he got in trouble with the popo.
Yeah, I know. You told me.
So.
Yeah. Well, I guess you'll have other opportunities to share his stories.
Yeah. which is why I think I'm okay with sticking with the Rocket Raccoon origin story for this one. That is insane. Actually, you know what? I had questions on this and I think this would fit perfect. Fish skin grafts on other animals. What fuck? Can we talk about that?
Yeah. Yeah, tilapia skin is like proven to be such a good like kind of skin graft option. And it started getting like very popular with like wildfire animal burns, pretty much. So like burn victims from wildfires, and tilapia skin was used to like heal those burns. So I'm not sure about the story that he was talking about specifically, but yeah, it definitely gets innovative in the clinic. Especially in like wildlife clinics, I think that we as like a nonprofit organization, we just don't have the money or the resources to get a lot of like the fancy things that cat and dog hospitals get. So definitely creativity occurs a lot, I think. And I'm sure he has other stories about that. But I think that in these kind of like settings, you just have to kind of make do with what you've got.
that's crazy. Koji, could you imagine that?
Hey, that's better than bleeding out.
Definitely.
It's
one thing to like take your own skin from like your butt cheek and put it on your face. But like, you know, like road rash victims or anything like bad accidents like that. That's definitely one thing. But fish skin, like tilapia skin, man.
Yeah, and that's not like you. Speaking of bleeding out, one time we like there's this something called like I think it's Quick Stop, which is that stops heavy bleeding, and it's like a medical component, and we didn't have that, and the vet was like, you know what works really well? Coffee grounds, and we were like, what? And then he was like, yeah, we can use coffee grounds to stop this bleeding, and so we like went to like make our morning coffee, and we're like, okay, like let's use the coffee grounds to like we'll collect them and put it, and it'll be our like makeshift Quick Stop. So definitely like things we have to know alternatives, and they do get creative. I was impressed that he knew that. He has a lot of wildlife vet experience, and I was just like, wow, this is something I never would have thought would function for stopping bleeding.
Wow, but it did. That's like a direct hit of caffeine, and that animal is like completely wired.
Could you imagine the raccoon on that?
No, I don't want to imagine that.
Yeah, we definitely owe you guys a visit. We got to come see this and explore your area of Costa Rica and just see all the things to see, and your organization as well.
Definitely. You're welcome here anytime.
Yeah, it's definitely on the list of places for us. We have quite a few, but that's one of the top ranked places, I think, amongst the team that we want to get out to Costa Rica and explore. You know, essentially both organizations that we've been so lucky to work with both you guys at Toucan Rescue Ranch and Carr and her team over at Jaguar Rescue Center. Her howler monkeys seem a little bit more crazy. I don't know how that's going to go there, but looking forward to it nonetheless. Well, I think we're getting to a point where we can wrap the show, even without Andres. I'm going to give you shit, Andres. So I hope you listen to this. And let's talk about Toucan Rescue Ranch and how people can connect and get involved with the program.
So you can definitely check us out on our website or toucanrescueranch.org. We also are on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok. We have fundraisers going on all the time. Right now, we're really pushing the Howler Monkey fundraiser that just got launched. So we're super excited about to make the project an official program. You can also do things such as celebrity adoptions, where you can adopt this cute little girl and help us feed her for a year. And then you'll get to meet and greet with the a celebrity that you adopt, basically, or like the animal that you quote adopt, because it's not real adoptions. And
disclaimer.
Funny story. One time somebody, I'll actually speak about this, because one time somebody thought that they could actually adopt our spider monkeys that we have at the sanctuary, and they were so angry when they realized that it wasn't indeed that they were getting a spider monkey mailed to them. And we were like, are you crazy? Like, all we do is promote like wildlife going back into the wild, and wildlife should not be pets. And then they had already like sent their donation, and they were like, can you please send me back my money since I'm not getting a spider monkey? And we were like, what the heck is wrong with you people? But anyway, so we have also like a $2 for toucan club if you want to do something that's like a bit more economically friendly. It's just like a $2 donation. That's, I think, a monthly donation, and it helps us feed our toucans that we have, and also that are part of our sanctuary or are part of our release program as well. So there's definitely a lot of ways to help us out. We're always, you know, looking for any kind of support from, you know, people, as we don't get support from the government or anything as a nonprofit organization, that we really do rely on, you know, fans and our audience to help us out.
Well, hopefully we can expand that a little bit and drive some more your way, so that enclosure for the howler monkeys can be built up and they can practice their swinging in a sandbox environment. Well, I think this is a good place to wrap. Thank you, Tessa. I think the last thing I got for this episode is, what is with the Costa Rican organizations we work with and their names being one thing, and what we talk about in the episode has absolutely nothing to do with it? So we have Jaguar Rescue Center, and we never once talked about jaguars. And then we have Toucan Rescue Ranch, and we talked about toucans for like 2 seconds.
I can talk about toucans longer if you want. I love talking about toucans. I have a toucan tattoo.
That's commitment right there.
They're my favorite bird.
I can relate. I have three real animal tattoos and then one mythical animal tattoo. Nice. I'm trying to think. I've lost track.
Ethan, you didn't wear your toucan hat. You said you would.
Okay. So I was really hoping you wouldn't notice.
I noticed.
I brought it. It's right here.
What the heck?
And I forgot to put it on.
No. We're going to have to re-record.
Yep, from the top.
Well, that would give Andres time to come back, right?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Well, thanks for calling me out. That's appreciated. That's the first time I've been called out on the show. I did wear a T though.
Okay.
I don't know if you can see it. There is a T for Tessa.
I appreciate that. T for Tessa as well.
Let's not go too far. I'm kidding. But yeah, I did plan on wearing the hat, and I put my headphones on because Koji and I were trying to figure out why my volumes were so low, and then you jumped on and it just didn't happen.
You can blame me. Well, I'll take the blame.
No, this is my fault. I'm scared.
You can just Photoshop the hat when he's post editing.
Whoa.
So Koji's like, okay, now you've gone too far. T for Tessa was funny, but now this is way too much.
Talking about the post wizarding skills that he's got.
Yeah, this is true.
Oh, he's got them. I have no idea. I have no doubt that he can do it. It's just I personally don't want to bog him down because we have a lot of stuff to do.
I can imagine.
Well, all right. I think, this is an excellent place to wrap before we ramble anymore. Appreciate you, joining us, Tessa, the ghost of Andres. We appreciate you too. And we're excited to, head down to Costa Rica at some point. Thanks for joining us today.
It was lovely chatting to you guys. Hope to see you guys here soon.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Wild and Unprotected Podcast, brought to you by Wildscape Productions. Follow us on social media at Wildscape Productions. For more information on our documentary series, Shoreline Stories, visit wildscapeproduction.com. Stay tuned for our future episodes, as we have so much more in store for Wild and Unprotected.